Good morning, members. I call the meeting of the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Committee to order. Members, we will begin with approval of the minutes, and Representative Frankie moves the approval of the February 15th, 2017 minutes. Any additions or corrections to the minutes as presented, members? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the minutes of February 15, 2017 as presented, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The minutes are approved as presented. Members, we have a new member. And I don't know if it's too early. I couldn't resist. So I'd like to welcome to the committee Representative New. And Representative New, maybe if you want to do kind of an introduction of kind of where you're from. And when we first did the introductions the first couple of weeks here, we shared maybe one thing you would like to maybe accomplish or consider exploring on property taxes.
Excellent. I'm Ann New, Representative Ann New, serving the majority of Chisago County. I'm just missing a few precincts in Chisago County. And frankly, I'm excited to be on the committee. The biggest concern of my constituents are property taxes. We're one of the highest tax counties in the state, so awesome. Glad to be here.
Thank you, Representative New. Welcome to the committee. And we all share those same issues, we are a very high tax state, and property tax is a very complicated area, so I think we're all still trying to figure it out. With that, we have with us Commissioner and Policy Director from the Department of Revenue, and we're going to talk today about Representative David's bill, which is House File 893, and this is actually in Tax Committee, so we don't have the bill before us, we're going to talk about it, and they're going to introduce it on Representative David's behalf and also on the Governor's behalf. So welcome, Commissioner and Mr. Cummings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This morning we are going to highlight for you the provisions of the Governor's tax bill that are in this committee's jurisdiction in property tax, local aids and credits, and some other areas. So, and then we will be presenting the full bill in the full committee later this morning. So we look forward to answering any of your questions and providing you with information. And then, Mr. Chairman, I know you have a very ambitious agenda today to get through also the agency's policy and technical bills, also very important bills to the department. So thank you again for allowing us to present all of these to you today.
Thank you, Commissioner Ballerina. If I could, Commissioner, just quickly. Members, we do, as the Commissioner pointed out, have a lot of information to go through. So if you have questions, if we can keep them brief and poignant, that would be awesome. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chairman, we will walk through all of these provisions in the order that they do appear in the bill, which I know isn't before you, but just for housekeeping purposes. But I wanted just to highlight the three main areas that we're going to be presenting for you today. First, there's a couple of provisions that relate to tax relief for farmers. And, Mr. Chairman, we appreciate your work in this area in particular as well. The important work that our local governments do, local aid programs help provide essential services to Minnesotans across the state and help also reduce the pressures on local property taxes. And then there's a couple of provisions that deal with leveling the playing field for Minnesota businesses and bringing some fairness into a couple of those areas. So we'll go through each of those briefly for you today. First, there's the buffer compensation program. As you know, in 2015, a buffer laws were enacted, and this program is aimed at providing some aid to farmers who are putting this either farmland or other 2A land into the buffer program. This would allow for an annual payment of about $40 per acre for each tillable acre that's converted to buffer, and the payments would be made for about 5 years. So, again, this is to help farmers make some of those transitions of putting that land into the buffer. You may also be aware that through the USDA, there's about $350 million coming into the state. The state will match some of that for a CREP program, and that program will work alongside this program. So if the acreage qualifies for each of those, they would be entitled to claim each of those. The next provision deals with debt service equalization. This is an existing formula that goes out to school districts to help with high debt service tax rates and where they have, particularly where they have a low tax base. This is an issue that many of you may be hearing about in your jurisdictions, where because of the way that the levy is situated for school buildings, that there's sort of a town-rural divide, and farmers and folks who live in town are sort of at odds about how to pay for those school buildings. And, of course, we want to deliver great schools for all of our children across Minnesota, and to do that, they need great facilities to be educated in. So this is a partner to the next provision, and again, Mr. Chairman, we appreciate your work and that of Representative Marquardt on these provisions. There are also two additional small changes. One is the Ag Homestead Credit Modification and the Home Office Deduction, which would limit the amount of your home or the property tax refund to the part of your home that is being used for residential purposes versus any office that you might have in your home. The School Bond Building Agricultural Credit, this provision may be familiar to many of you if you served in last year's legislature. This was in House File 848. Representative Chairman Droszkowski, Representative Marquardt have worked on this bill. The governor has also included it in his bill because he agrees that this is an important issue that we need to address for Minnesota farmers, particularly at this point in time when commodity prices are so very low. We need to provide some relief to farmers. And so this would provide a 40% reduction to the property's the amount of the property tax attributable to those school bond levies. And, of course, this would also help make sure that future levies could be passed so that we can continue to provide school buildings that students need. This would provide relief to many Minnesota farmers, about 75,000 farmers across the state of Minnesota. The next provision deals with an existing program in Minnesota, the Senior Citizen Property Tax Deferral. This existing program helps seniors stay in their homes by allowing them relief from their taxes that are due typically in October. One of the challenges that we've observed at the department is that when seniors realize that they may have trouble paying that October bill, the deadline that's set in statute for this program has already passed. And so this proposal would recommend moving that July 1st date to November 1st so that when a senior realizes that they may need help paying their property taxes and they want to apply for this program, that they would be eligible. It also lowers the occupancy rate from 15 years to 5 years. We know that trends in housing have changed over time, and empty nesters might move to a smaller home, and so they may not meet that 15-year residency requirement in that home. So that occupancy requirement would be moved from 15 to 5 years. And we think this is it's a small program, but would allow more seniors who are facing these circumstances to stay in their homes. Mr. Chairman and members, I'm now going to turn it over to Mr. Cummings to describe some of the provisions that deal with local government aids.
Thank you, Commissioner Ballerly. Mr. Cummings, welcome.
For the record, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, we appreciate the partnerships we have with local units of government. These recommendations are aimed at providing targeted aid to ensure the best possible outcome for Minnesotans and to reduce the pressure on property taxes. Article 2, Section 3 deals with the Indian Child Welfare Act, ICWA. This was included in House File 848. And, Mr. Chair, prior to 1978, Indian children were placed in foster care at a nationwide rate of 10 to 20 times that for non-Indian children. These children often lost all connections with their families, extended families, tribes, and cultural heritage. The goal of the Indian Child Welfare Act is to ensure that Indian children remain with their parents whenever possible. Providing these services is costly, and those expenses are primarily borne on counties. The governor and lieutenant governor recommend an aid payment of $10 million annually that would be proportionally distributed based on the non-federal share of cost incurred by county social service agencies for out-of-home placement. Local government aid, Article 2, Section 14, and county program aid, Article 2, Section 15. The governor and lieutenant governor recommend increasing county program aid by $20 million per year and county program aid by $10 million per year. This proposal would be effective for aids payable in calendar year 18. Local government aid and county program aid are important tools in the state and local partnership. They help local governments pay for vital needs such as local roads and public safety, and also help keep property taxes low. LGA funding is currently below the level of aid paid out in 2002 before adjusting for inflation. After 2002, LGA was routinely cut for years, during which time local governments increased their property taxes. County program aid is also below actual aid paid out in 2002 before adjusting for inflation. Wanted to move on to the riparian protection aid. This was also included in House File 848 as passed by the House passed last year and is in Article 2, Section 16. During the 2015 legislative session, laws were enacted requiring riparian buffer land on public waters and drainage systems. Landowners with land on public waters are required to have buffers in place by November 1st of this year. The deadline is November 1st of 2018 for land on public drainage systems. The following factors are used to distribute the aid: the number of acres classified as 2A under Section 273.13, the number of centerline miles of public water courses, and the number of miles of public drainage system. Mr. Chair, I'll move on to some local economic development provisions. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith make strategic and targeted recommendations to assist local units of government in economic development. Article 2, Section 17 deals with the property tax exemption for a soccer stadium. The Governor and Lieutenant Governor recommend providing an exemption from property tax for the proposed soccer stadium in St. Paul. Providing a major property providing a property tax exemption would make this stadium consistent with other major league stadiums in Minnesota. This exemption from state and local property taxes would apply to other properties with any properties with the primary purpose of providing a stadium for professional soccer. The site is currently exempt from paying property tax in its current use. Article 2, Section 18 deals with Medelia aid, Mr. Chair. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith recommend $31,000 in additional aid to Medelia and $15,000 in additional aid to Watonwan County to mitigate the loss of property tax revenue due to the Medelia fire. These amounts are equal to the projected property taxes abated by the city and county due to the fire. This additional aid would expire after fiscal year 2037.
Mr. Chairman and members, the next set of proposals deals with...
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Deals with trying to level the playing field for businesses in Minnesota. And there are a number of provisions. We'll address the two that, again, pertain to this committee's jurisdiction. The first of those is modernizing rail property tax. The Governor and Lieutenant Governor's budget proposes that we update our rail property valuation statute and raise the levy to bring the increased revenue from that value to local, state, and county governments. As you may know, the statute under current law requires the department to get to market value when assessing this property. Given the current assessment practices, assessment requirements, we don't think we're able to meet that standard under the statute. And so this current method is for valuing railroad property is outdated. It's often called the Wisconsin blue chip method, and at one point was the industry standard, but many states have moved on, including Wisconsin, and it's time for Minnesota to do the same. So the governor is proposing that we use modern accepted practices for valuing railroad property. And in addition, the governor is proposing to expand the taxable property to include rolling stock, which are the locomotives and cars. This is personal property for the railroads, and currently under Minnesota law, some personal property of the railroads is already taxed, including docks and wharves. These changes would be made at the state level, but again, as you may know, under the state assessed property system, we allocate that across the state to local jurisdictions as well. And so those jurisdictions use those valuations, and the local jurisdictions under this proposal have the options to either increase the levies to use that revenue for needed investments or provide property tax relief to other businesses and homeowners. This provision has been proposed before by the governor, and as we have discussed with a number of committees prior to this year, there is a lot of concern about the 4R Act and its interaction with this proposal. The department has studied that very carefully, and we wouldn't be proposing this if we didn't think that we had a strong case under the 4R Act. The 4R Act is a federal law that prohibits states from imposing a different ratio, a different rate, or a special tax on railroads. And because this proposal does none of those three things, it is consistent with the 4R Act. The additional of personal property is consistent as well. Again, there already is some personal property of railroads that is taxable under Minnesota law. And in addition, other payers in that CI levy, including pipelines and airlines, have some of their personal property subject to Minnesota tax as well for the property tax system. So we look forward to answering any questions you may have on this. I'll ask Mr. Cummings to share the next item in this area.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll talk about Article 6, Section 19, dealing with updates to the taxation of non-ferrous mining. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith recommend replacing the net proceeds tax on non-ferrous mining with a gross proceeds tax at the rate of 2.75. This tax would be imposed on the gross value of minerals sold by a non-ferrous mining company. While not currently mined in Minnesota, non-ferrous minerals include copper, nickel, lead, zinc, and titanium, to name a few. And as I said, they're not currently mined. If any of these materials were to be mined, the companies extracting them would be subject to the net proceeds tax. This tax is paid in lieu of property taxes, similar to how ferrous mining companies pay the production tax. Ferrous mine is the iron or taconite. The current tax is determined by calculating net proceeds, which are the gross proceeds from non-ferrous mining minus expenses. This creates a situation where non-ferrous mining companies, particularly in the early years of operating a new mine, may not have any net proceeds. This causes disparate treatment of this type of mining compared to ferrous mining companies that pay a production tax regardless of their profitability, or to homeowners who pay a property tax regardless of their income. Active non-ferrous mines would not be subject to the property tax. The gross proceeds tax would be collected and distributed in the same way as the current net proceeds tax. The rate of 2.75 is intended to provide parity with the tax burden on non-ferrous mines. And I wanted to note, Mr. Chair, that we will provide our calculations to the committee on how we believe that that provides parity. We just want to make sure that the information that we're providing is public information. And right now we're trying to ensure that that is public information.
Mr. Cummings, is the production tax currently, is that based on gross proceeds?
Mr. Chair, the current production tax is based on tonnage. So as you think about how you'd impose a tax on non-ferrous minerals, taconite and iron ore over time has become so standardized that it's easy to go by ton. But if for non-ferrous, to go by ton or by ounce for gold or titanium, we would have to have maybe 10 or 20 rates in statute that would continue to be updated. So for non-ferrous, they try and what is the equivalent to providing that production tax for the local units of government. We're trying to provide the best proxy that would be the same as that production tax. So this is our attempt to do that. So we look forward to working with you to make sure that there's parity between our ferrous mines and our non-ferrous mines.
Thank you.
Wanted to talk about the changes to the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act. These were also included in House File 848. Changes to the Sustainable Forest Act were initially discussed after a report by the legislative auditor in November of 2013. Many of their recommendations are incorporated into this bill. It was important to acknowledge that the Sustainable Forest Act provides economic and ecological benefits as well as tax cuts. This proposal updates and changes SFIA eligibility requirements, certifications, covenant length, calculation of the incentive payment, withdrawal procedures, transfers of ownerships and definitions, forecast land and claimant, and other minor changes. These recommendations are supported by Minnesota's forestry industry. The legal summary provides a detailed account of all of the policy changes. We'd be happy to go into some of the changes in more detail. With that, Mr. Chair, in closing, Mr. Chair and Member, Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith support a balanced, common-sense approach to tax cuts that prioritizes economic opportunity for Minnesota families while protecting the state's long-term fiscal health. This year, Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith have proposed cutting taxes for more than 450,000 Minnesota families to help build an economy that works for everyone, everywhere in Minnesota, and have recommended targeted and reasonable reforms to elements of our tax code that need to be updated to keep pace with changing practices in our economy. We look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, and members throughout this session on developing a balanced package for Minnesota families and businesses. Commissioner Bowerly and I will stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. And Commissioner Bowerly, Representative Kurtos has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Bowerly, thank you for talking to us this morning. I have a couple questions regarding the slide with regard to the railroad property tax. I was wondering if you could tell me how much you estimate would be additional revenues as a result of modernizing this tax. And there's a reference to Minnesota's procedures to align them with other states by expanding the tax. Could you tell me approximately how many other states you desire to emulate?
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Bowerly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertas. The proposal would raise about, I'm looking at about $11 million in 18-19. That is a 19 number, and it goes up from there. It raises about 20 in the out years in 20 and 21. And with respect to the other states, Mr. Chairman and Representative Kurtos, if I could ask John Van Derden to join us to provide a little more detail on the other states that use these assessment methods.
And members,
Van Derden can introduce himself.
Members, there is a revenue note in your packet that's got these numbers in it. So if you want to dig through, I know there's a lot of information there. Mr. Bender.
Sir, Mr. Chair, members, my name is John Van Derden. I'm the City Assessed Property Supervisor at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. To the question about the number of states that use this methodology, the organization, the National Conference of Unit Evaluation States, there are approximately 35 members who adhere to these similar standards. That is essentially all of the other states within the United States that use central assessment for unitary property such as railroads, pipelines, and utilities.
Representative Hertas.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it also notes that this revenue would allow for local property tax relief to homeowners and businesses. How would that be distributed?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hertas.
Commissioner Bowerly.
The Department of Revenue assesses statewide property and then apportions out the value to different local jurisdictions because this property is, of course, spread across the state. And so counties where this property is located, because we would be using these new methods that would change the would reflect an increase in value, an increase in tax, and so those local governments would also reflect that as well. And what they could, the choices that the local governments would have at that point would either be to raise their levy to account for that new revenue, or they could keep their levies flat, but because it would be spread differently across the tax base, it would reduce property taxes for other payers in the local jurisdiction.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Bowerly, it would just seem to me that in the end, when you raise costs, input costs, indirect or direct, in the business community, they don't really pay for it. It'll end up being paid by consumers and businesses in the cost of goods that they effectively haul or transfer. So it seems to be, to me, to be a little bit of a spiral of inflation to say that you're going to take the money and then you're going to give it back, but consumers are going to pay for it, so we got to take money to give it to you so that you get relief. It just seems to start a vicious cycle of what I really don't support. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question in regards to a couple of these items have some FTEs, and just kind of wondering if this is going to be a permanent ongoing position or if this is temporary. Notice we have a couple in the railroad assessment. We have a couple in the buffer section, and I am really hoping you'll tell me it's a typo on the watershed district where we have 10,000.
Commissioner Bowerly?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Burke, I'm quite sure that we wouldn't be adding 10,000 employees. The department currently consists of about 1,300, so that must be a typo. We apologize, and we'll take a look at that and fix it.
That would be one FTE for each acre of land that the state buys each year. So
with respect to the others, so the... when we make tax law changes, there are often implementation costs that are shown. So often what you see in the technology costs is that is more of a one-time cost. It takes us a certain amount of resources maybe to update our system to allow for certain types of filing. Other costs are ongoing because, for example, if the there may be ongoing review costs or ongoing costs. So you mentioned, I'm sorry, Representative, you mentioned too, and I didn't write them down, so I apologize.
Representative Burke.
Mr. Chair, I noticed the FTE increases. There was a few in the buffer section and the railroad reassessment.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair and members. So I'll speak to these individually. In terms of the buffer compensation program, this would be additional FTEs, but they would be time-limited. So while it doesn't end within the time horizon, this is a five-year program. So then it would be limited to those 5 years within the program length. I will note in this the FTEs deal with both the Department of Revenue and a Board of Water and Soil Resources. One of the things that we're going to have to do is they're going to apply to the Department of Revenue, but then they need to get certified with the Board of Water and Soil Resources to make sure that they match the requirements. So that's some of the background work that we need to get done that would be ongoing for those 5 years. And then related to rail, in terms of ensuring that our railroad property tax system works well for our customers, as Commissioner Bowerly said, there would be some immediate updated to our changes to our integrated tax system that would need to get done, which is why you see a little bit more in that first year. And then ongoing, there is additional FTEs, and that is to provide, you know, the best quality assessment and customer service to these customers, as there would be a change in order to these types of property tax assessment rules and laws.
Representative Burke? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a question, too, on the buffer program, and I'm curious as to where, how you arrived at that, that five-year payment plan for farmers that put land into buffers. You know, if it's a payment for establishing the buffers, it should be an upfront payment, I think. And if it's a payment for the actual taking of the land, you know, we're looking at taking $5,000-$6,000 an acre land and then paying a total of $200, which doesn't seem to be adequate. I think there's issues of compensation that are going to come up with the buffer bill. So where did your plan come from, and how did you decide to fund it at that level?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair and members, so I wanted to talk about a couple components here. First of all, let's talk about the $40. The $40 is a statewide average of the property tax for that for those types of land. Obviously, average means that half are going to be above and half are going to be below. We're trying to find the best number for property taxes. We know that in these cases there are farmers that are having to change what's going on. So for the property tax portion, we wanted to ensure that there was a little bit of that there was a little bit of a buffer, maybe that was the wrong word, in terms of trying to make this work. In terms of the 5 years, We wanted to provide, as people are making these changes for the first few years, we wanted to provide the ability for them to get a payment. Now, but we also understood that this was a transition. This is only for the people who are making it due to the changes in the governor's law, the governor and the legislature's law that was passed in 2015. So this isn't going to be applicable for people who made the changes 5 or 10 years ago. So we also didn't think that it was quite the best policy to have a long-standing program for some homeowners or some landowners who made the change because of the law rather than the landowners who made it 5 or 10 years ago or even before then. So we were trying to strike a balance. We were trying to find a way to, talk about the costs incurred by landowners without having, you know, the long-term liability, without creating a dissonance between types of landowners. We tried to strike a balance, but Representative Anderson, we really do look forward to working with you. If you have thoughts or suggestions on how to improve this or think about how to making something better here.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think the compensation issue is going to come up. We need to address that. And as far as the property taxes, I think what's going to happen is that this highly productive land, or in many cases highly productive land, is going to be reclassified as either wasteland or grassland, which is going to lower the property tax anyway, which is going to cause a shift at the county level in who pays these taxes. And I had a bill up, I think it was last year, that would have the state pay the property tax on the land that goes into buffers. And I don't know exactly how many acres they used. Maybe it was all land and all buffers, but the fiscal note to that was $15 million over 2 years. So it's a situation that if we don't address it, the counties are going to have a shift in taxes, and it's going to be a shift to other taxpayers. So I think we need to look at these issues before we go a whole lot further. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So it sounds like, Mr. Cummings, it's more of a focus on property taxes rather than the property rights that were taken away. That's not necessarily compensated for here. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, this proposal brought before the Property Tax Committee deals primarily with the property tax impact on these landowners who are making the change due to the requirements under the 2015 buffer law.
Thank you. So on with the buffer stuff, Mr. Cummings and Commissioner, I'm curious why these were not included, maybe as from coming from legacy funds rather than the general fund. After all, legacy is to restore, enhance, and protect. And if indeed that's what the idea of buffers is, why are we not using legacy money? Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to continue that conversation with you. The governor has proposed general funds for this.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have some questions on the budget notes. I'm not sure what we're referring to these as, but specifically for the modernizing and expanding the railroad property tax. And I want to follow up with what Representative Rarick was asking about some of the FTEs. So just for my edification, I want to make sure that I'm reading this correctly because I'm sure I'll see more of these in other committees. So in fiscal year 2018, it looks like you're proposing to add 2.21 FTEs, and it's a positive net fiscal impact. Is that correct?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to open up to that page. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so there is a positive fiscal impact, but there are other things that are going on in the proposal other than the FTEs. So the large state net fiscal impact deals with these types of properties being coming onto the state general levy. So what you're seeing here is an impact for the general levy, so that the types of the cost due to the FTEs is much smaller, and I think you can probably see that on fiscal year 18 and 19 of the expenditure line, on the general fund expenditure line, that's where you'll see the cost of the FTEs. Now, once you get into fiscal year 20 and fiscal year 21, then you're starting to see a reduction. Those are dealing with the changes due to the property tax refund. Those are interactions. And so you'll see an expenditure increase due to the FTEs that will be added, and then you'll see an expenditure reduction due to less property to tax refunds going out, because homeowner property taxes under the modeling would be going down due to railroads picking up a larger share of the levy due to the updating of assessment practices. Not sure if I did that very well, but that is what is going on in that expenditure line.
Representative Barr?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So just so that I understand this, so we can't technically evaluate these individually. They have to be evaluated as a whole.
Mr. Cummings?
When we're looking at these individual items.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barr, we'd be happy to give you the amount of the FTE line, and we can work with your fiscal analyst, Ms. Schell, to provide each of the various elements individually rather than having a net, if that would be helpful for you. We'd be happy to do that.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question. When we look at FTEs in these documents, are these contract employees? Are these people being redeployed from other areas, or are these permanent employees?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barr, these would be new permanent employees. We in some instances, we do, for particularly in technology areas, we may contract, but those would not show up as FTEs under the state's budgeting system.
One last question,
Barr.
I promise. Thank you, Mr.
The government
Chair.
Is going to grow.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Barr.
So when I see, and thank you for your latitude today, Mr. Chair. So when we show FTEs in fiscal year 2018 at 2.21 and fiscal year 2021 at 1.74, that's a difference of 0.47. How do we eliminate a 0.47 FTE?
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Bowerly?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Barr, when I share your when I look at these, I don't, you know, FTEs are full-time equivalents, right? They're not actual employees. And we have 1,350 dedicated employees at the Department of Revenue. So sometimes what that is we are allocating resources for this to somebody is working on that part-time, and they are working on something else part-time. So it really just represents the effort level or the perhaps the hours, but they obviously don't represent an actual human. We do have some part-time or seasonal work at the Department of Revenue, but that's the more of the rare case.
And one last, I promise.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so those seasonal or part-time employees, are they considered contract employees or state employees?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barr, they are state employees. They are considered part-time or seasonal. Those are classifications within the state's classification system. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, I've got three more on the list, Representatives Marquardt, Erickson, and Nelson, and then I'm hoping we can move to the testifiers after that. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and a question for Commissioner Bowerly or Mr. Cummings. The formulas for local government aid and county program aid, are those the dollars that are being put there into the same formulas that currently exist?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Marquardt, yes, we know there is conversation about making some changes, but these are under the existing formulas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, well, I appreciate the governor's and your efforts to focus on property tax relief, because I think, as someone mentioned, like a business, even if you don't have profits, you still pay property taxes. Or if you've got a couple and someone loses their job, the income goes down, but you still have the property taxes. When I go out and about, I talk to a lot of senior citizens, and the property tax refund program really helps them, but they're always concerned about being able to stay in their home, and that's really important. On the buffer, so I appreciate the efforts on trying to get a handle on the rising property taxes that we have. On the buffer zone, I think that is something we all need to deal with, because I remember back in 2015, I think most of us rural members all voted for it. And I think we tend to try to forget that sometimes, but I don't know about whether or not if you did or not.
Mark, many of us voted for a bill that had it in it.
Well, I understand. But I go to some of these meetings, and people try to pretend like I had nothing to do with this legislation. And I think if we go back and look, many of us hit the green button in support of the buffers. Now, I agree with you, you know, on a lot of these bills, but I think this isn't just the governor. I think we all, as Representative Anderson saying, we're trying to find some ways to make it work, but we can't totally escape liability for the fact that it is law, because many of us voted for it that are sitting around this table. And the last thing I want to mention is on the railroad, and I worked with this bill last session, so I understand the complexities of trying to value things properly, but you know, this is one of those types of property, like these big, that the Department of Revenue is responsible for distinctly. And it is, you know, when someone isn't paying their fair share on a market value, other businesses or other folks are paying more. And one thing I like about this, it, you know, where it would go through, and if you get the correct valuation, and a lot of times it's based on cost, the original cost, the income, the market value, which is tough to do. I mean, when a railroad company sells, I mean, can you really compare that? And you really can't. So there's all these complexities. But if the market value goes up in these cities, if the railroads are paying more of their fair share, and some may argue about that, but if in fact they're being underassessed, then that does raise the market value in all these other communities, so they can lower the property tax rates for all the other businesses right now who are paying more because the railroads aren't paying maybe what their fair share is right now. So I think it's worthy of a good discussion. I'm glad the governor's included this in the bill. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good discussion, Representative Marquardt. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Always good to see you. And Mr. Cummings, I know I see you every day. I can smile at you and enjoy you. I just want to express my concern about the buffers. Yes, I know it's law, and yes, Representative Marquardt, you're correct, and we voted for it. But the concept of the buffer is what concerns my farmers in East Central Minnesota, that this is a taking of land, and the concept did not come from us. The concept came from the administration. So, you know, you need to keep this in mind that when, and I've walked these acres in Moax County, where creeks are running through, and seeing what farmers have done to honor conservation. So the concept is something that needs to be reexamined. And I wish the governor would come out and walk in some of these fields where many of us walk to see the great work that farmers do to preserve that stream that runs through their farmland. And yet now they're giving up all these acres. I mean, I have farmers who are going to give up hundreds of acres in East Central Minnesota where we farm on sand in some places. And it's just something that needs to be taken a look at. And then, Mr. Chair, I have a question about, you know, the school bond, the school building bond credit that was in the tax bill last year, as of course the buffer was. Is that going to be retroactive? Because we have ballot questions, and you have Representative Rick, you're going to have a ballot question, and the farmers are going to be taxed at the rate that is presently in law. And there is great consternation, again, among the farming community, because unless this is retroactive, when this bill may be signed into law, and who knows, maybe the governor is going to veto again, we don't know, but this is something that is, if it's not retroactive, it's not going to help these bond questions that occur in May. So that's a comment, and I want you to think carefully about that, because this could have been law, and we wouldn't have to worry about that. My third question is, what is the federal share of out-of-home placement for ICWA? Mr. Chair and Commissioner
Madam, Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, just to, if I might, I hear what you're saying. I would, you address buffers, and I know that the governor has said that he is open to discussing ways to make that bill better. And so we
thank you.
We will certainly make sure that we convey to his office and to his staff the concerns. With respect to the second issue you raised,
the bond
about mm-hmm. school bonds. So I think I want to be careful when we talk about the word retroactive, because I want to just be really clear about what we're talking about. So this proposal, as it was in 848, would cover existing bonds and the amount that farmers would be paying going forward. It would not compensate them for past taxes paid. So I just want to be really careful about that and make sure we're not confusing people. But it would apply to existing levies and bonds that are already out there that are on the books.
Okay. So thanks for that clarification.
Mm-hmm.
Then how about ICWA?
And then for ICWA, I'll turn it over to Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Cummings.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, the non-federal share, which is the portion that would be covered under this bill, is that is runs at about $25 million per year, and I can get the specific amount. What the in the governor's proposal, they are looking to reimburse $10 million, so then it's a share of that $25 million. Now, so that is the non-federal share. Now, you asked about the federal share, Representative Erickson. That is a number that I can produce for you and make sure that you and the fiscal analyst and Mr. Rubis have.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
And my final comment is, Commissioner Bowerly, we worked really hard, and you worked so hard with the Mille Lacs area and the governor as well with the relief package, and that was supposed to include the abatement, which was in last year's tax bill, but I see is not in the governor's proposal. So I hope you would remind him that that's still very important to all of those who have businesses on Lake Mille Lacs who, again, are going to face catch and release. And it's not looking good for us. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as we I got more of a comment than a question, but as we go around here and talk about FTEs and focusing only on the number of new employees that might be hired. A cautionary tale, I guess, I have here is the city of Blaine, after their second water treatment plant problem, where they basically had to shut down the water supply twice because of mistakes and problems. The city manager, I believe it was on the news, talking about they had one person doing four people's jobs because they didn't want to hire any more employees, and because of that, things got missed. And things didn't happen. These FTEs that we're hiring for these new programs to go out and do this work for the state, if we don't do it, there may be mistakes made. In this situation here, for two times in a month, they were without water in their city. So, I mean, we need to be careful as if we only focus on FTEs and not what these people do, that we're going to miss the opportunity. And I too, do not want to grow government any larger than it has to be, but it needs to be right-sized and not just worried about getting rid of FTEs, because at some point something's going to happen like what happened in Blaine with their water problems. And there could be lots of other instances we could point out where stuff has happened because there haven't been enough people on watching to make sure the stuff and getting the work done that needs to get done by the state.
Thank you. Thank you, members. Thank you, Commissioner Bowerly and Mr. Cummings. And we look forward to further discussion, maybe as early as next hour. So with that, thank you both. We've got some people who would like to speak. Mr. Smith, are you here? And I'm going to ask, we've got a long list of testifiers here. Many of these items we will be discussing much more in depth as we get further into session. So if each of you testifiers could keep your comments brief, we've got a robust agenda ahead of us. Mr. Smith, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the division, I'm Dane Smith, President of Growth and Justice, and we're a nonpartisan policy center that seeks a broader and more inclusive economic growth for Minnesota. And toward that end, solutions that both business leaders and social justice advocates, private sector and the public sector, can agree on. We support many elements of the governor's tax proposal, which includes many features in the 2016 tax bill already approved by the House and which received broad bipartisan support. The key features I want to speak to today are related to our new Minnesota Rural Equity Project, which is aimed at policy and local initiatives that restore Main Street vitality and reduce inequality and disparities in greater Minnesota. First, we support the restoration of local government aid. Basic public infrastructure, streets, police, water, sewers, local city efforts to attract business are crucial to economic competitiveness in rural Minnesota. The governor's proposal puts $30 million more into LGA and CPA. We think this is a minimum level, and we actually support proposals sponsored by members of the majority caucuses in both chambers, including Representative Anderson on this panel, to add considerably more to LGA, restoring it to the 2002 levels before big cuts were imposed during two recessions that decade. LGA holds down property taxes. Second, we support the property tax reductions for farmland proposed by the governor and which also have bipartisan support. It was fitting that this initiative was announced in Worthington, where a sorely needed school construction was levy was defeated last November. We were there earlier this month talking to economic development officials, and we know that ag property tax rates are creating problems for these school referendums and levies. And nothing is more important for our rural communities than providing first-class education opportunities and investing in our increasingly diverse homegrown talent. Finally, I'd just like to say a quick word on behalf of the Working Family Credit, even though that's an income provision and not the purview of this division, but it is important for rural Minnesota. Research by the Minnesota Budget Project shows clearly that rural counties and families will get a particular boost from the Working Family Tax Credit, emphasis on working. It stands to benefit roughly 15% of the households in many or most rural counties, or almost twice the percentage in our more affluent metropolitan regions, for the simple fact that incomes are lower in greater Minnesota. So thanks, members. I'm happy to try to answer questions and provide any further information as requested.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Members, any questions for Mr. Smith? Thank you, sir. Ms. Kelleher. Welcome to the Property Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent every locally elected school board member from around the state. And let me talk first about today, and you've heard so much about it, is this school building ag tax credit. This is huge, members. It's a great idea, and I'll let you in on how this work got done. Representative Druskowski decided we needed to do something out there. It was pretty evident that rural schools were in trouble because the farmers could not afford to vote for the school bond issues. So we sat down and with a couple other folks, and we probably spent 3 months going through different angles, looking for a way to spread it that didn't shift onto communities and then actually brought the dollar number down. And I have to admit, I was sort of, reluctant at some points, thinking we'd never come together. It's just one of those things where we always talk and not make any progress. And kudos to Representative Druskowski that came up with this idea. And then he basically put it all the way through on the tax bill. Let me just give you what that means in numbers a little bit. Over the last 3 years, the metro area has passed 26 capital bonds, and 3 have failed. If you do the numbers, that's about an 89.6% passage rate. Now let's look at outstate. Greater Minnesota had 65 bond issues. 51 failed. So they're only looking at a 56% passage rate. So at some point, the inequity from rural to metro is becoming very apparent. And this would be huge for outstate districts going forward. So I really encourage you to think about that. A kid should be a kid regardless of where their zip code is. The second thing in here we'd like to recognize is the debt service equalization. This is a program that just almost has floated away into nothingness and really needs an infusion of cash. And it's really about tax fairness. Regardless in what school district you live, it has the same effort to give a dollar. And we feel that program, getting more money, will actually get more school districts in it. And last but not least, I know this isn't a property tax. If you really want something that goes for kids in this bill, It is in the Minnesota State High School League language. It's on page 107. And basically what the league would do, and it's a sales tax exemption, it would make grants to fund, recognize, promote high school students' participation in extracurricular activities. This fund for kids around the state lets them be involved regardless of how much money their family has. So if you would consider those things going forward, Mr. Chair, I would really appreciate it. And I'll say one more time, thank you for your work on the Ag Building Credit. It really made a difference.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Kelleher. Other questions from other members? Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Mr. Peterson. And again, testifiers, let's keep it to property tax if we can. Welcome, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's great to be here today. My name is Bradley Peterson. I am here today on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities and wanted to speak briefly to the local government aid portion of the governor's proposal. First off, I want to thank Governor Dayton for his ongoing commitment to the local government aid program and its mission of helping communities across the state provide services that residents and businesses rely on and that really go a long way to making cities across the state large and small, vibrant, and thriving. But, of course, the governor's proposal is only the first word in this discussion. The CGMC continues to have the goal of getting back to the 2002 level. We're still $45.5 million short, and that's why we're supporting the efforts of Representative Paul Anderson and House File 672 and his 22 geographically diverse and bipartisan co-authors that would increase the local government aid appropriation back to the 2002 level over calendar years 2018 and 2019. And so we really believe that we need a tax bill this year. 2 years without a tax bill has been unprecedented. 3 years would be unbelievable. We look forward to working with you to do that and to have a tax bill that has a local government aid increase in it. Thank you.
A tax cut bill, Mr. Peterson, right?
It's all tax relief, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Questions for Mr. Peterson? Thank you, sir. Mr. Lundell. Welcome, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell of Schools for Equity and Education. Always good to come over to a tax committee. I love being in the education committees, Representative Erickson, but it's always nice to have a risk.
So, Mr. Lundell, this is less than 12 here then, isn't it?
Schools for Equity and Education is a 60-member organization comprised of low property wealth school districts that are located throughout the state. The organization believes that school levies are an appropriate place to concentrate on providing property tax relief, and we're very supportive of the acts that have come out of this committee in the past, especially the work done by the chair on the Ag Bond Credit, which we strongly supported last year and we continue to support this year. We believe that the adjustments for tax relief to school levies, the target for that, the tax committee is an appropriate place to do that, and we look forward to this year talking about some of the things, the property tax levies that we think could be reduced by work completed in this committee. The organization strongly supports the Ag Bond Credit that came out of this committee last year and is also in the governor's budget in Article 2, Section 2, but also Article 2, Section 4, rather, but we also support the governor's commitment to increasing the debt service equalization. Low property wealth districts are located throughout the state, both metro and non-metro, and the unique needs of ag property really do demand that ag bond credit, and so we're very, very supportive of that. We think that this is a comprehensive approach. We don't think it's an either-or. We think we need the ag bond credit and the increased debt service equalization, so hopefully we can work with you as we move forward. We've got other bills that are coming through the process. Hopefully they'll also get the hearing in here. But, again, we look forward to working with you and the governor as we move forward. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell. Questions for Mr. Lundell?
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Hall. I'm sorry. Representative Hertas has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lundell, have you and your members done any calculations or what the impact might be with the buffer law and possibly the reclassification of all of those high-value acres, what that will mean in lost revenue for schools?
Mr. Lundell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas, no, we have not, but I can certainly get us cracking on that. So, thank you.
Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Lindell. Mr. Hall.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Max Hall. I'm the legislative representative for Texas Local Government at AFSCME Council 5. AFSCME Council 5 is a labor union representing more than 43,000 state, county, and municipal employees throughout the state of Minnesota who advocate for good public services. And so specifically when it comes to House File 893, we would like to testify on the increases for local government aid and county program aid. As mentioned by other testifiers, county program aid and local government aid are really critical programs for local governments in order to sustain their public services for their citizens. And other testifiers have mentioned that $20 million is going towards local government aid and $10 million is going towards county program aid. And these provide necessary services in the public safety sectors, infrastructure, and other industries. As alluded to in the presentation from Commissioner Bowerly, county program aid and local government aid since 2002 has not necessarily increased. And we think that the funding mechanism for local government aid and the appropriation from the state general fund needs to go back to those levels. And we think that this is a very important step in making sure that we can fund LGA and county program aid. And so to indulge your request, Mr. Chair, I'll make my comments generally brief, so I'll conclude with that. And we'd like to publicly thank Governor Dayton, Lieutenant Governor Smith, Commissioner Bowerly, Mr. Cummings, in coming up with this good tax proposal for Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall, and thank you for your brevity. Members, questions for Mr. Hall? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And next we have Ms. Bjorgi. I'm going to... Welcome, Ms. Bjorgi.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lydia Bjorgi. I'm in here to testify on behalf of BNSF Railway in opposition of Article 5 of House File 893. Titled Railroad Recodification, this article does two things. First, it attempts to tax the personal property of railroads operating in Minnesota. And second, it establishes a new property tax valuation methodology. Pertaining to the first item, as a rule, Minnesota taxes the real estate of businesses operating here. You all know that. But the commercial and industrial tax does not include the personal property of those businesses. Taxing railroad personal property like locomotives, rail cars, other equipment, while continuing to exempt the personal property of other businesses, clearly violates Section 306 of the Railroad Revitalization Regulatory Reform Act of 1976, better known as the 4R Act, which you heard about earlier. Section 306 of the 4R Act prohibits discriminatory taxation of railroads. In a nutshell, under these federal provisions, state property tax programs cannot treat railroads any worse than other CI property taxpayers. So, in states where personal property tax is applied across the board to all businesses, railroads are subject and pay that same tax, such as in Wisconsin. But where a personal property tax is not generally applicable to other businesses, such as in Minnesota, an attempt to tax railroad personal property would clearly violate that 4R Act. The fact that Minnesota cannot tax railroad personal property was addressed in past litigation, 1983, Burlington Northern v. James. Federal District Court judge found that, quote, there is no doubt that Section 306 of the 4R Act requires that BN's personal property be exempt from taxation, given Minnesota's exemption of other commercial and industrial taxpayers' personal property. In that same case, the Minnesota Department of Revenue stipulated that because virtually all personal property is exempt, Burlington Northern's personal property would likewise be exempt. You heard that utilities and pipelines pay personal property tax. The courts have also found that it's improper to just simply point to one industry. The correct comparison is to look again at whether that personal property tax is generally applicable. And if it is, then the 4R Act would allow it. In Minnesota, it's not. You also heard that we pay personal property tax on docks and wharves. It is true that we pay property tax on the underlying real estate of those of docks and wharves, but not the personal property tax of those structures themselves. Under the second item, Article 5 attempts to codify railroad property valuations, even though Minnesota's property tax statutes do not do so for other commercial, industrial, or utility properties. is unique and somewhat odd to us. It would remove us and other railroads from the usual rulemaking process in which information is submitted, evaluated. There's an orderly and a transparent fashion to it. In fact, it would codify into statute a number of unusual appraisal methodologies and use them only for railroads. So those are the legal and regulatory problems with the provision. Allow me just another minute to talk about one practical issue. Railroads currently pay $52 million in property taxes every year. We've estimated that in addition to that state number we heard earlier, with the, if you add in kind of the local property taxes that we would pay, this would be another $66 million tax on the industry. By the end of 2017, BNSF alone has invested over $700 million since 2013 into our infrastructure in the state of Minnesota. Other railroads have also reinvested in Minnesota. A huge increase, something of this magnitude, could put those investments, which are meant to improve service and safety, at risk. Mr. Chair and members will be happy to elaborate on these issues if you have any other questions, but in some, Minnesota railroads and BNSF would simply ask you not to adopt this provision of the governor's tax bill.
Thank you, Ms. Bjorge. Questions, members? Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Carlson.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association that consists of 10 regional center greater Minnesota counties and 4 suburban counties here in the Twin Cities metro area. I do want to thank the governor for the provisions in the property tax article, including the riparian buffer compensation program, the debts, the school building bond agricultural credit, the increase in riparian aid, and finally the increase in county program aid. While this is a $10 million increase, I do want to warn the committee that as they consider the formula as well as the appropriation for county program aid, that this is insufficient to fund the a formula change in House File 609, chief authored by Representative Backer and co-authored by a number of you. I do have a handout here showing the need for this change because of the substantial loss that many greater Minnesota counties have experienced in the last 15 years. But simply superimposing the formula in that bill on top of the $10 million increase would actually result in a reduction in county program aid for 25 counties, 23 of which are greater Minnesota counties and are those with lesser tax base and higher tax rates. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Questions, members? Okay. Thank you, sir. Ms. Cadoon.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Just want to make two comments. One is our concern over the overall policy direction that the governor's budget bill and tax bill is taking us. Of the $1.4 billion surplus that's currently projected, the governor's recommending to spend about 90% of that, growing government spending by about 10%. Tax relief contained in his overall budget is about a net $54 million, but within that is tax increases on businesses of over $100 million. Specifically want to address the property tax increase that's contained in the governor's recommendation. It was talked about earlier regarding the Federal 4R Act and the increase on the railroad properties. The governor's recommending with this, they're increasing the statewide general property tax levy to $927 million. As was mentioned, this is likely preempted under federal law, the Federal 4R Act. This is, I think, recognized in the bill. They have a severability clause that's on page 98.1 is the line that it starts on, which means if it's held not to be allowed under federal law, that provision would be struck down. But what would seem to remain would be the statewide levy increase would still remain in law if that occurs. And so what that would mean was you'd have property tax increases on all the businesses within the state. And also you'd have the local governments that have been relying on this valuation increase And if that would be struck down, obviously that would mean those local governments would probably have increased budgets that they had been relying on, and those tax increases would obviously then get passed on to homeowners and businesses. So I just want to go on the record in opposing those increases on the railroads, what ultimately could impact the rest of the business community. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Cadoon. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cadoon, what are other states doing in regard to a railroad tax? Is anything happening in our area, you know, like our five-state area, wherever, you know, Burlington Northern runs, or do you know? I know I didn't ask Ms. Boria that when she was up here, but
Ms.
can you respond?
Mr. Chair, I think that question is probably better directed to the railroads. I do not know what's happening in the other states.
Thank you. We'll find out.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Mr. Ongaro? Is there anyone else that would like to speak to the bill, to the proposal? Good morning, sir.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Frank Ongaro. I'm the Executive Director of Mining Minnesota. We represent the non-ferrous copper-nickel industry in the state of Minnesota. I'm here today to oppose the governor's position on changing the net proceeds tax to a gross proceeds tax. Non-ferrous mining companies, while none are up and operating in the state at this time, unlike the iron ore industry that pays a production tax, would pay a net proceeds tax in lieu of local property taxes. The governor's proposal to go from a net proceeds tax to a gross proceeds tax would significantly increase the tax on an industry that does not yet exist and would do absolutely nothing but chase mineral investment away from the state of Minnesota. About the only thing that I can see that's something to agree with on the Department of Revenue and the governor's proposal assumptions and analysis is that they anticipate Polymet to be in production in 2019. Everything else seems to be an assumption and an analysis that would result in a tax that conservatively could quadruple in the early years, could increase the tax 8 times, according to their analysis, on a company that's trying to get up and running. The state of Minnesota should be offering incentives to industry to come and invest in this state, not disincentives. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll end my comments related to the net proceeds tax changing to a gross proceeds tax. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ongaro. Questions, members? Thank you, sir. Anyone else who would like to testify on the proposal? Mr. Peterson, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'll be very brief. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. And three things or issues we appreciate that are in this bill. The school bond issue, I think everybody's very familiar with that. Very big issue for our farmers. They're very excited and then disappointed because you were looking at real money on the table for farmers. It would have been very helpful this year. It'll be helpful going forward. We continue to have bonds go down. One went down 2 weeks ago in western Minnesota, pitting neighbor against neighbor, and it would be very helpful to move this along. Also, the buffer payment to counties, and we've worked very hard on the buffer with many of you, Bill, as it's gone forward, and if we're going to have enforcement for the buffer legislation, we want to have it at the local level. And so it's important to have that funding for the counties. The final thing is the riparian aid. It's the first time in this discussion that we've put money on the table for compensation for farmers where their land is coming out. $40 an acre, you know, when we tell farmers about that, that's a little low to a lot of farmers when they're considering it, but recognizing it's the first time we're having this discussion. So I appreciate it and just wanted to share those words with you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks for your testimony, Mr. Peterson. Questions, members? Thank you. Anyone else who would like to discuss the bill? Okay. With that, members, we are going to move on. And not having a bill before us, we're simply going to move on to the 2015-16 policy and technical bill that was before us last year. and that is in your packets, House File 1226. Mr. Cummings, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the second fine piece of legislation by Chair Davids today.
He only has fine pieces of legislation, Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to present and discuss the 2015, 2016, and 2017 Department of Revenue's policy and technical bills. A special thank you to Chair Davids for carrying all of the policy and technical bill provisions. Mr. Chair, I will be providing some opening remarks, and then our attorneys will be walking through the provisions of the policy and technical bills. We'll be going over three bills, Mr. Chair: the 2017 policy bill, the 2017 technical bill, and then first, the House File 1226, which contains policy and technical bill provisions from 2015 and 2016. So let me talk a little bit about the guiding principles when putting together the 2015-2016 policy and technical bill provisions. We decided to create one bill for all 2015-2016 policy and technical bill provisions, starting with what passed in House File 848. So that means all modified and negotiated language during the past two sessions is included in this bill, including the language updated at the request of Mr. Lilienquist from the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, Ms. Cadoon from the Chamber of Commerce, and Ms. Larson from the Business Partnership. In addition, this bill includes other policy and technical bill provisions located in other parts of House File 848 as passed, including Zappers, which we'll talk about in the full tax committee, and the SFIA policy and technical bill items included 848, but not in the policy and technical bill articles of 848. We removed the provision dealing with the removal of the expiration date on supplemental agricultural credit warrants that was passed in House File 848. They are already in the process of going to missing property at Commerce as directed under current law. We updated effective dates, Mr. Chair, and then we included a purpose statement so that people know what the bill is when they're looking it up online and saying, what's this other bill? Provisions not yet agreed to as part of House File 848 at the end of last session, including local lodging taxes or the CPA data lag, were not included in that bill. As the department stands by many of those provisions, we pursued them as part of our 2017 package. One of the strategies to achieve the department's vision is that we listen to our customers and identify and develop recommendations to improvements of the revenue system. Throughout the year, the Department of Revenue notices items many times after working with customers in the tax code that could be clarified, updated, or corrected. These ideas are developed, edited, and improved throughout the interim. After development, they are drafted into bills, and here we are today. Many people tend to view the provisions in these bills as either policy or technical, yet many times it's not as black and white. It usually is grayscale, somewhere in between. So in preparing these bills, we have to make judgment calls. If you'd make another judgment call, we'd be happy to work with you or change the designation. We prepare two bills at the request of the legislature. I would like to offer you all of our assistance to ensure we have the opportunity to address issues that come up in these bills as they're brought forward. These are small but important provisions that will make our tax code better. So if issues arise, we thank you preemptively, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to work with you. We look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, on incorporating both last year's and this year's policy and technical bill provisions in the conference committee report. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to our attorneys within our department. We'll walk through the bills as a resource to this committee. Thank you again for scheduling these bills today. Mr. Gustafson is here, and he will start with Article 5 of House File 1226, which deals with the 2015-2016 items. And as a reminder, all of these items have previously been passed by the House.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Welcome, Mr. Gustafson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, again, my name is Kyle Gustafson. I'm a staff attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Starting and directing your attention to Article 5, Property Tax Section of House File 1226. Section 1 adds the state of Minnesota as a political entity so that income-producing property data, when collected to the state for making state-assessed property valuations, is deemed to be private or non-public data. Section 2 changes the definition of air commerce, such that airline companies that make three or more flights in or out or within the state of Minnesota during a calendar year that's defined to be air commerce. Section 3 provides that flight property does not include aircraft with a maximum takeoff weight of less than 30,000 pounds. Maximum takeoff weight is a standard aviation term. Section 4 adopts a definition of person that's used in 270C to make it consistent with the definition used in other taxes administered by the commissioner. Section 5 defines intermittent or irregularly timed flights to mean flights in which departures and arrivals are negotiated with the customer, including charter flights. And Section 6 deletes language that excludes aircraft with a gross weight of less than 30,000 pounds. As noted above in Section 3, the statute will instead use the term maximum takeoff weight. Section 7 provides that airline companies must file reports unless the commissioner deems that the company is exempt. It also clarifies that the commissioner may prescribe the content, format, and manner of air flight property reports. The section also adds a cross-reference to the definition of electronic signature. Section 8 provides that if an airline company does not file a report, that the commissioner may file a report based on the information that the commissioner has or the commissioner may obtain. Section 9 allows, adds a new subdivision to allow the State Board of Equalization to order county assessors to reassess all or part of a parcel in a county if the board deems that the property has been over or undervalued and the assessment is grossly unfair or inequitable. Section 10 eliminates the requirement that county boards of appeal and equalization provide a printed or typewritten copy of meeting minutes to the commissioner. Sections 11, 18, and 19 clarify that all transportation pipelines are subject to assessment and taxation without regard to the material that is being transported through that pipeline. Section 12 provides that the criteria for combining wind energy conversion systems is amended such that systems may be combined if they're constructed within the same 12-month period rather than within the same calendar year. Section 13 allows the commissioner to grant an extension for someone to file a wind energy production tax report for up to 15 days. Sections 14 and 15 require local assessors to enter construction and valuation data into the records, into their records as directed by the county assessor. Section 16 provides that if a county or city assessor fails to timely mail valuation notices to taxpayers, that the assessor must mail an additional notice to property owners and convene a supplemental local board of appeal and equalization meeting or local review session. Section 17 provides that, clarifies that Class 1B property, that's blind and disabled homestead property, to the extent it has a value in excess of $50,000, that the remainder of the property is classified as either 1A or 2A, whichever classification is appropriate. Section 20 requires utility and railroad property owners to challenge the commissioner's order or recommended values to also include counties as co-defendants in suits or appeals from those valuation notices. Service, however, would only be directed to the commissioner and not to the individual counties. Section 21 provides that utility and railroad company appeals to the tax court from orders of the commissioner must be filed within the same time periods as other tax appeals under Chapter 271. Section 22 makes various changes in how utility and railroad companies appeal their valuations. Specifically, this change would provide for what information must be provided by a company in an administrative appeal and also prescribes the time periods and adjusts the time periods for a company to first of all file an appeal and for the commissioner to review that appeal. Section 23 provides settlement authority to the commissioner in utility and railroad valuation cases when it is in the best interest of the state. Section 24 clarifies that if a taxpayer files an administrative appeal both in tax court, well, an administrative appeal as well as a tax court appeal, that the administrative appeal is deemed to be dismissed and the commissioner does not need to review it administratively, and instead the tax court appeal would proceed. Section 25 would add a new section related to the equalization of public utility structures. such that after making the apportionment required by rule, that the commissioner shall equalize the values of the operating structures to the level accepted by the state board of equalization. This would make this equalization process consistent with other types of property equalization. Section 26 clarifies that the statutes related to local boards of appeal and equalization, making it very crystal clear that they do apply to local boards rather than county boards. Section 27 provides that county boards of appeal and equalization may not make a change in value to benefit a property if the owner has denied the assessor access to that property. This is consistent to the limitations on local boards of appeal and equalization where a property owner has refused entry. Section 28 extends the deadline from December 1st to February 1st for county boards of appeal and equalization to certify a trained member of their board. Section 29 clarifies that taxing authorities only need to announce the time and place of their regularly scheduled meetings at which budget and levy discussions will be had if they have such a meeting. Section 30 removes the requirement that towns with a population over 5,000 townships with a population over 5,000 and communities receiving taconite aid file property tax levy reports. These reports are no longer needed for these towns and communities as they're not subject to levy limitations, even if this body turns levy limits back on. Section 31 clarifies that appeals evaluation notices may be filed in tax court prior to May 1st, only on valuation notices received from county assessors. Section 32 clarifies and modernizes the language that's used for the procedures for taxing districts to sell tax forfeited land. Section 33 clarifies that when a governmental subdivision wishes to purchase tax forfeited land that it currently has subject to a conditional use deed, that when it wants to purchase it outright, that it first needs to reconvey that property back to the state before the commissioner can issue a deed that is not subject to a restricted use. Section 34 requires cities receiving aid to register an official email address with the commissioner. Section 35 requires the Commissioner of Natural Resources to certify the number of watercraft launches and watercraft trailer parking spaces in each county for purposes of administering aquatic invasive species prevention aid. Section 36 requires the Commissioner of Natural Resources to certify to the commissioner the counties that have complied with the requirement to establish guidelines for addressing aquatic invasive species. Section 37 clarifies that the 5-day rescission period for sales made by contract for deed does not apply to the sales of tax forfeited land. Section 38 restores an exemption for personal property of an electric generation facility that was inadvertently repealed during the unsession of 2014. Section 39 is the repealer. The first one repeals an obsolete provision that provided a one-year notice period for the expiration of redemption for properties that were bid in by the state prior to 1935. And Section B repeals the equalization formula by rule that's in rule related to public utility structures because equalization will instead happen pursuant to the new statute that's being added. And that concludes Article 5.
Thank you, Mr. Gustafson. Members, any questions for Mr. Gustafson or Mr. Cummings on this? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gustafson, I know that when I hear policy bills in education and enact them, there's sometimes a cost that I don't realize is going to result. Are there any hidden costs to whomever this these new sections are intended that you know of, Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, for all of our policy and technical bill items, these have been evaluated both by the divisions, the taxing divisions that would administer these changes, as well as by our research divisions. And they have both our administrative divisions have said that these would be a zero cost, and as well our researchers have found that these would have a no revenue impact. So zero revenue impact.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I doubt the DNR is not going to find some way to charge for collecting the number of watercraft launches and the number of trailer parking spaces in each of our counties. I think that's going to show up someplace, Mr. Chair.
Well, it's interesting, Representative Erickson, when the government wants to make changes, there's not a cost associated with it, but when the legislature proposes it, there always seems to be. So, anyway, thank you. Representative Protoss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, I was wondering if you could just expand a little bit or clarify under Article 5, Sections 2 and 5 and 6. It appears when you read the language of this that you're really seeking to tax more heavily small planes, maybe charter services that might fly someone in on a fishing trip or something, but it's really troubling. Three flights a year makes you a commercial airliner. Can you tell me what you're trying to do there?
Mr. Gustafson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Protoss, what these changes are trying to do is provide clarity and transparency for the companies that might be subject to these provisions. It also is adopting standard industry terminology where current statute is a little bit behind the times as far as the terminology that is used. As Mr. Cummings indicated, these provisions have neither a cost or a revenue impact, and there would not be an additional collection of tax from these provisions.
Representative Hurtas?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, I'd just like to kind of point out a scenario. So let's say a couple of individuals have a little company that they own a plane and they share the use of the plane and they are the customers of that company and they pay for their proportional use of the plane. So they're being deemed as a commercial airline. And we're talking about small aircraft with less than 30,000 pounds of gross weight. So we're making what really is oftentimes a small private use, a commercial entity that is going to be taxed differently.
Mr. Gustafson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, depending on the circumstances of the scenario you described, that company likely is already subject to the air flight property tax.
Vice Chair Hurtas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No more questions.
So, members, this, as Mr. Cummings pointed out, these items did all get passed as part of the they were included and passed by the legislature as part of House File 848, last biennium's tax bill that ultimately was vetoed by the governor. So they passed the legislature last time. That doesn't mean they don't still deserve more scrutiny. So, members, I would encourage you to take these with you back to the workshop, back to your workshop, and if there are any items in here that you'd like to apply that type of scrutiny with and research with the department, I think they would enjoy and be interested in that as well. So thank you for your discussion around last year's or last biennium's policy and technical provisions, Mr. Cummings and Mr. Gustafson. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, we're going to do a little hopping around with the, there are a couple other provisions in the bill, and so if you're okay with doing a little hopping, we'll do that quite quickly, and then we'll move on to the policy bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Quickly, Mr. Cummings.
Okay. I wanted to direct your attention to the this same bill, which would be Article 3, Section 14, and Mr. Gustafson will briefly go through that, and then we'll move on to another article, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Gustafson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Article 314 would provide a simplified process for filing property tax refunds. Renter's refunds by authorizing the commissioner to require owners and managing agents of residential rental property to furnish the commissioner through a simple process a copy of each certificate of rent furnished to a renter. This is the provision that Mr. Cummings indicated that the department had worked with the Multi-Housing Association.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gustafson leaves, I was hoping that we could do Article 7, and then we'll invite Ms. Berry up to do a couple sections in Article 4.
Thank you. Mr. Gustafson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Article 7 addresses a number of technical changes to the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act. Section 1 provides that forest management plans required under SFIA must be registered with the DNR. It also adds a requirement that if land is enrolled in various programs such as the Agricultural Preserves Program or Green Acres, that the entire parcel that contains those acres may not be enrolled in an SFIA. This section also clarifies that land classified as 2C managed forest land cannot be enrolled in SFIA either. Section 2 requires that on the request of the Commissioner of Revenue that the DNR must annually verify that claimants have current forest management plans. And Section 3 would repeal an obsolete formula for calculating SFIA payments. The formula is no longer necessary because the SFIA payments are paid on a flat $7 per acre amount.
Thank you. Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to note that these were a limited set of recommendations based on the OLA report that I mentioned in the governor's budget. There are other provisions in the governor's budget that do cost money. We have deemed these to not cost money, but there are there is a larger set of recommendations that goes farther into addressing the OLA report's recommendations, as we talked about briefly with the governor's budget presentation.
Thank you. So, Mr. Cummings, we're going to move to House File 1227. Thank you, Mr. Gustafson.
And then I wanted to ask Ms. Berry to come up to do Article 4, Sections 15 and 16, and then Mr. Schultz will go through Article 4, Section 17. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. It's Ms. Berry?
Yes.
Welcome. And we are still on House File 1226.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. Article 4, Sections 15 and 16 are cleanup language. To clarify that it's the Commissioner of Revenue and not the Commissioner of Management and Budget that pays each city of the first class an amount equal to the total amount of the firefighter relief surcharge. That's it.
Thank you, Ms. Berry.
Wanted to ask one final person, and that is Mr. Schultz, and he will do Article 4, Section 17. And then that would complete our presentation after Mr. Schultz of this bill.
Mr. Schultz, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Ronald Schultz. I'm a staff attorney for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. As Mr. Cummings said, we will be going over Section 17 of Article 4. It relates to mining companies. I'm sure you're all aware that mining companies pay an occupation tax in lieu of corporate franchise tax. This section amends the occupation tax statute to delete a reference to an obsolete net operating loss provision. The repeal provision applies to tax periods for which the net operating loss carryover is no longer available.
Thank you.
And so, Mr. Chair, that completes our presentation of House File 1226. As I mentioned before, Mr. Chair, if people have ideas or questions, we'd be open to hearing them and open to working on any changes as needed, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We appreciate that, Mr.
I did hear from the counties, the assessors, and they wanted to ensure that there was some clarity about one provision dealing with shared litigation. So we will work with them as the session moves forward and hopefully present something to you that works for them, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Okay, Mr. Cummings, let's move to 1227. Sorry. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're now going to move to House File 1227, which is the 2017 policy bill. Mr. Gustafson will start with Article 2.
Mr. Gustafson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Article 2, property tax and local government aids. Section 1, adjust the formula for apportioning the value of flight property to Minnesota such that apportionment base in part on the revenue ton miles flown by an airline company and the total departures by an airline company within the state. Then Section 14, repeal the availability of alternative apportionment methods upon petition to the commissioner. These provisions simplify filing for airline companies and also provides uniformity across the airline industry. Section 2 provides that the commissioner have the authority to determine the types of exemptions for which a taxpayer must file a statement of exemption. Section 3 provides a filing extension for the taxpayer to file a report under the Solar Energy Production Tax by up to 15 days. Sections 4, 5, and 6 deal with the certificate of real estate value, first of all by allowing the commissioner to set the threshold amount of consideration paid for real estate that would trigger the need for the filing of a CRB, and the other provisions remove references to the paper copies of CRBs, as all CRBs are now filed electronically. There is no longer the need for reference to paper copies. Section 7 adds a paragraph to allow the commissioner to require an individual at a city or county who administers property tax to complete additional training to promote uniform and equitable implementation of the property tax laws. Section 10 would expand the classes of property of tax administrators who are subject to penalties for knowingly failing or refusing to perform the duties under the property tax laws. Sections 8 and 9 address the homestead application and would require an applicant to provide the Social Security number of a non-occupying spouse. This is necessary for the department's statewide cross-checks that is based on Social Security numbers to ensure that couples are not receiving multiple homesteads throughout the state. Sections 11 and 12 clarify the training compliance requirements for local and county boards of appeal and equalization, and specify that the transfers of those boards' powers, when they do not comply, those duties are transferred for at least 2 years. And then Section 13 creates a data lag for the calculation of county program aid. That concludes the article.
Thank you, Mr. Gustafson.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to direct your attention to one other section within the bill, and that is Article 3, Section 12, and I'll ask Ms. Berry to come and present that section.
Thank you. Ms. Berry, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This provision consolidates the three filing dates for the firefighter relief surcharge so that there now would only be two filing dates. So the firefighter relief surcharge is assessed on fire, lightning, and sprinkler leakage premiums in the cities of the first class, and the current filing periods are unusual, 5 months, 2 months, and 5 months. And they're consistent with the other insurance taxes, which are filed annually, biannually, or quarterly. And so consolidating it to just two filing dates would be easier for the taxpayers and also easy administration for the department.
Easier for taxpayers. I like that. Thanks, Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just I want to point out that she needs to identify herself for the tape. I know you identified her, and I don't think either time she spoke, she identified herself for the tape, for the record.
Thank you.
Yes, it's Susan Berry, Department of Revenue. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Berry, and Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummings.
That is our presentation of the policy bill. We do have a few sections in our technical bill that we would like to go over, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So we're moving to House File 1228, members.
Mr. Chair, we're now moving to, as you mentioned, House File 1228. That's the 2017 technical bill. I'll ask Mr. Gustafson to work through Article 2, and then we've got a few sections in Article 3 that we'd like to go over.
Mr. Gustafson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Again, my name is Kyle Gustafson from the Department of Revenue. Article 2, Section 1, corrects an erroneous cross-reference within the air flight property statutes and corrects the subdivision reference related to the net tax capacity of flight property of airline companies. Section 2 clarifies that certain certifications issued by the department expire after 4 years, for example, certification for the tax calculation course. Section 3 clarifies that the credit for property and tax relief area applies to both the homestead and non-homesteaded portions of qualifying property. Section 4 removes the requirement that the Office of Administrative Hearings separately send copies of annexation orders to the department. The department obtains this information from OAH's annexation database. Section 5 clarifies certain population-based definitions to accurately reflect the data used in calculating CPA. And Section 6 modifies language to reflect the correct uses of the term ratio, and also adds language clarifying that the data used in calculating town aid is the most recently available data as of January 1st, as is the current practice consistent with LGA. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gustafson. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, we'll now move on to Article 3. I'll ask Ms. Berry to go through Section 2. Sections 8 and 9, Mr. Chair, we would respectfully think that those have had quite the hearing, Mr. Chair. I thought Representative Carlson did a good job outlining the provisions within Articles, Article 3, Section 8 and 9. So maybe we will focus on the new provisions in Article 3, Section 2.
Thank you. Ms. Berry, welcome back.
Yes, Susan Berry, Department of Revenue. Article 3, Section 2, it clarifies that when a special law grants a local government the authority to impose a local tax other than the local sales tax, and this would be, for example, an entertainment tax, admissions, food or beverage taxes, and if the Department of Revenue is administering the tax, then the terms in the special law, unless the special law defines them, of course, will be defined the same as they are defined in sales tax statutes or sales tax rules. And also clarifies that the local government does not need to specifically adopt this within their local laws.
Thank you, Ms. Berry. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, and then I'll ask Mr. Schultz to come back up for the presentations of Section 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, some clarification for some mining provisions.
Mr. Schultz, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, again, my name is Ronald Schultz. I'm a staff attorney for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Sections 3 and 4 relate to the occupation tax. These sections remove obsolete apportionment language from the occupation tax language. Section 5 relates to production tax. It consolidates the language relating to the imposition of tax on other iron-bearing materials into a new paragraph. And it also changes the term direct reduced iron to direct reduced ore to make the term consistent with its use in the rest of the minerals chapter. Sections 6 and 7 relate to production tax distribution. These sections clarify distributions of production tax revenue to cities and towns affected by mining and to counties with an electric power plant. The provision relating to the electric power plants was also in House File 848 last session.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, again, with all of these three bills, we first wanted to thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving us the opportunity to present these bills today. And then we also wanted to offer an invitation for any member or staff who wanted to further dig deeper into any of these provisions. We look forward to working with you on these throughout the rest of session. And then we'd like to find a home for these to get signed, Mr. Chair. So we look forward to working on that with you as well.
Thank you for all your work today, Mr. Cummings. Members, with that, please take these back into the workshop. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.